So years ago, there was a buzz about a young pastor who taught on the Day of Atonement, which is a Jewish holiday. In a groundbreaking sermon, I mean a sermon that was talked about by many, he brought a man dressed as a high priest into stage and a live goat. And he talked about the slaughtering of this goat the entire time. People raved on about urban legends and inspiring a bunch of young preachers to emulate this, to bring forth what had been in the temple that day. People around the world were bringing in animals to the pulpit. They were bringing in the goats and the doves. They were bringing in the animals. There was hay all over the place. But they didn't prepare for the fact that the animals do what the animals do in leaving deposits about the sanctuary. So they discouraged that. And we, of course, in our church do not do that. And I'm grateful that I don't have to deal with goats and such. But that's what happened with Christ. As he came into this holy place, it was a place with merchants, and it was a place with money changers, and it was a place that was like the local mall, not like they had known the sanctuary and temple to be. And so I ask now, what happened to the sweet baby Jesus? It's been less than 3 months since he was lying in a manger, bathed in warm glow of starlight, and swaddled in the soft clothing. And now, just 3 months later, after Christmas, we meet an active Jesus. My goodness, he's already grown up. And he is bandishing a whip, turning over the furniture in the sanctuary and disrupting worship during the high holy days. I have a feeling we're not in Bethlehem anymore as I hear about Jesus disrupting worship in the temple. The story about the day Jesus disrupted the worship service in the temple is told in all four Gospels. In Matthew, it's in chapter 21. In Mark, it's in chapter 11. In Luke, it's in chapter 19. But John's version of the story differs in at least a couple of ways from the other accounts. First, Matthew, Mark, and Luke remember the temple disruption during the last weeks of Jesus' life. His actions inside the holy place fan the flames of anger as Jesus and are a part of what leads to Jesus' arrest. But in the Gospel of John, the incident happens at the beginning of Christ's ministry. Most scholars suggest that the chronological order of the three Gospels is more accurate, but John puts it at the beginning on purpose. This doesn't diminish the story of John's account at all, because John's purpose isn't to give a biographical account of the man called Jesus or to provide a history lesson. Rather, John is teaching us theology, to help us see what God was doing in Christ Jesus. The second significant difference between John's account and that found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke concerns Jesus' motivation for his actions in the temple. In the other three Gospels, the motive for Jesus' disruptive action is exploitation. The place of worship had become a den of robbers, according to Jesus, and he set out to rectify the situation. But in John's story, there's no suggestion that Jesus believed anyone who'd been exploited. Rather, the root of the issue is that the temple had become the local shopping mall, and the prayer and worship life of the people had become subservient in the interests of the merchants and the shoppers. By the time the incident in the temple occurs, sweet baby Jesus, he's all grown up. According to John, he started his ministry by turning water into wine at a wedding banquet, demonstrating God's abundance and showing that God was doing in his life, And then the mood, the feeling, changes quickly. It's as if we're blown down from the land of Oz along with Dorothy and Toto, as Jesus enters a temple that would have been exceedingly crowded in a politically charged atmosphere during some of the holiest days for the Hebrew people. Devout Jews like Jesus went to the temple in Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. Anyone arriving for worship would have been immediately impressed with the temple's structure. I mean, it was huge. It was a monumental building designed and impressed to make everyone be in awe as they walked in. Anyone entering the temple area would soon encounter a shopping mall of sorts. The shopping mall was actually necessary for worship to occur. Temple worship, you see, included sacrificing animals. Again, glad we don't do that. Unblemished ones at that. And if you're traveling to come to Passover, you can't bring an animal with you that's unblemished because the travel, the time it takes to get there, that animal will be blemished. Since it was difficult to travel to Jerusalem with an unblemished sacrificial animal in tow, pilgrims needed to be able to purchase animals when they got to the temple. And so, if they were going to participate in worship, they had to sacrifice an animal. Because the currency they carried in their pockets had an image of the emperor on it, it couldn't be used to purchase animals for worship. So the worshipers had to exchange their Roman coins for tokens at the money changer tables before they could purchase their unblemished, cherished, sacrificial animals. This means that money changers and animal sellers were absolutely necessary for temple worship. Again, there's the goat, there's the hay, and there's what they leave behind. This means the money changers and the animal sellers are there for business. When Jesus arrived at the temple on the first Passover of his ministry, something about the scene just struck a nerve with him, moved him deeply, and stoked him with anger. We don't think about Jesus being angry, but stoked him with anger. He couldn't remain quiet. He had to act, and act he did. He made a whip, perhaps out of cloth they used for bedding the animals, and he used that whip to drive the cows and the donkeys out of the temple. He also commanded those who had the birds in the cages to set them free. He turned over the money changers' tables and dumped out all their last coins. As he did these things, he proclaimed, "You made my Father's house a marketplace. You've made my Father's house a marketplace, a marketplace." With these actions, worship would have suddenly stopped. Interestingly, there doesn't appear to have been a mad rush to stop Jesus from doing all this. No one started to wrestle him to the ground, no police with tasers, no guns, no handcuffs, no nothing. They just let Jesus do this. Instead, when the animals are all out on the street and the birds are out of their cages and are sitting out on the sidewalk and the money changers are scrambling to pick up their coins from the floor, those in charge ask Jesus, "What sign can you show us for this?" In other words, what gives you the right to come in here and uproot our worship service? What miracle can you perform that would let us know you have the authority to stop worship in its tracks? And Jesus replied, "Destroy the temple. It will all be razed in 3 days." 3 days? Of course, he was talking about his death and his resurrection. But they're saying this structure took 46 years to build. How can you destroy it and build it again in 3 days? Of course, he was talking about his death and resurrection, which was clear to his disciples in retrospect. But that day in the temple, no one understood it. Certainly, not those in power. They thought he must be talking about the bricks and mortars and marble of the building in which they were worshiping. And they knew that there was no way to build it, that it had been under construction for 46 years at this point, and who could rebuild it in 3 days? When Jesus got to the temple that day, he saw a magnificent building. Crowds gathering, ready to worship, friends who hadn't seen each other for a long time being acquainted, and dealers of animals and exchangers of money. They would have nothing about that scene that was a surprise. And yet, when Jesus encountered the temple's shopping mall that day, he came face to face with the reality of that day. Merchandising had taken on the town of its own, and in the process, the people had lost sight of the purpose of the temple. Someone recently pointed out, for those of us accustomed to walking into the temple and finding them quiet, clean, and awe-inspiring, the brawling scene Jesus confronts, the caterwauling of sacrificial beasts, their waste, the chaos exchanged between buyers and sellers would become distressing. Most of us live far from a farm. Neither do we have exposure to sheep or goats, unless, of course, the live nativity has Micah in his sheep's outfit. Neither are bleating sheep like Christmas pageants. This is a wild and boisterous scene. Prayers would seem to be the farthest thing from the minds of the people in the temple that day. It would be the most for us. What Jesus found that day in the temple was something like Walmart on a Black Friday sale. Then it was a house of prayer. What he encountered that day were worshipers who were acting as if the purpose of the temple was to be a venue for livestock. As if its prime purpose was to provide a place where we could get the best buy on a beast, a place where we could get an exceptional exchange rate to trade our coins in for tokens. But you see, that wasn't the reason for the temple at all. The temple was a place for prayer, worship, encounter God, and see what new things God has done. But those purposes were completely drowned out by loud speaking announcing blue light specials. Remember those from Kmart? Specials over in stall 10 and buy one goat, get one goat free. Specials over in the little lambs for us booth. Discovering God, encountering the divine, discerning a calling of all those that day played second, maybe third or even fourth, to the merchandising, the selling and buying of commodities necessary for worship. And I haven't encountered a church in my lifetime where we've offered the opportunity to purchase livestock on Sunday morning. But I wonder if perhaps it's possible that, like those temple goers, merchants, and money changers, we sometimes lose sight of the real purpose of church too. I wonder if perhaps good and necessary parts of our lives as a community of faith might occasionally get in the way of our accomplishing God's given purpose for us. I wonder if sometimes God and necessary things intended to help us accomplish our purpose might actually hijack that purpose. The purpose of church, for instance, isn't to run programs. While programs are vitally important and helpfully serve our purpose, they're not our purpose. We don't exist for choirs, although I would never be without one. We'd miss it terribly, and there would be lots of gnashing of teeth if I took it away. And our worship would be far less worshipful without it. Likewise, we don't exist to run youth programs either, but they are essential to the church and in the growth of our faith. We don't exist for our committee structure. In fact, everybody loves Monday night meetings. Though it would be tough to operate this amazing place without people coming together. We don't exist to balance a budget, although balancing the budget is important. But too many years of deficit spending would imperil the health of the congregation's ministry. As scandalous as it may sound, our purpose isn't even to grow the congregation. Don't get me wrong. I want to grow the congregation, and generally a good thing when a church grows. But our purpose is not to become a church of 1,500 or 2,000 members. Instead, I think our purpose here in the church is to make disciples. Yes, that's simple, making disciples. And it also has to do with the proclamation of the good news of the gospel. Our purpose also includes the promotion of a world in which the poor have what they need, the hurting have comfort, the lonely know community, building a world in what racism gives way to respect. War gives way to peace. And all manner of death-dealing finds hope-killing actions give way to life. No, we are not in Bethlehem at the manger, in Jerusalem, in the temple. There are no livestock dealers in the gathering area, or money changers in the fellowship hall. At least, I didn't see them when I first came in. But I think Jesus' disrupting temple worship may serve as an invitation during the rest of Lent for the rest of us to examine our life together as a church and consider anew what our purpose is. And if perhaps there is anything, even good, necessary thing, that gets in the way of us fulfilling that purpose, if anything hinders our faithful fulfillment of God's purpose, then let us trust in the power of God's love. Let us trust in the power of God's love and ask God to help us disrupt those things so that we might see and be a part of whatever new things God is doing in our midst. Remember to look for the good news. Amen.